I'm Christopher Lydon with that noisy Scotsman Mark Blyth, the political economist who, right or wrong, is never in doubt about the meltdown, the euro crisis, the little green buds of an American economy. Welcome back to Open Source, this American conversation with global attitude, we call it. People on the street really keep asking me, what does Mark Blyth say about anything? I wish you'd just start with Dr. Jim Kim. How does the world economy respond to having a public health doctor, Haiti's friend, TB's enemy, Dartmouth College's president these last years, how does it respond to having a public health guy at the head of the World Bank? A humanitarian who has said out loud that he's not sold on neoliberalism and, as he put it, corporate-led economic growth.
All sounds very promising, doesn't it?
It's interesting. What's to make of it?
Well, here's a couple of ways you could look at it. I don't know anything really about this guy, to be perfectly frank, but let's look at the institutional context. So the bank and the IMF, as the so-called Bretton Woods institutions, had been in the wars long before we got to the crisis. And the crisis has actually been good, particularly for the IMF, because they've got things to do now, like bailing out countries and telling them how to be austere and all that sort of stuff. For the bank, it's less clear. The bank has been internally riven for several years now. Different factions involved. Some people want to push what was called the governance agenda. For some people, that was a fig leaf for like worrying about politics at the end of the standard economic analysis. But for others, particularly anthropologists, sociologists, and others that have been increasingly hired by the bank, they're serious. To be a development bank means more than to be just another bank or something like the IMF. So in one way, this is a reflection of the evolution of the institution itself. Another way to think about it, though, is it's kind of a bit like the G20. Why does the US like the G20? Because it's just large enough to control and just large enough to look democratic. So by putting someone in there who is essentially, as I understand it, someone with a great deal of experience of working in and living in the United States, but is not actually American, is an economist but works on health issues, you're kind of genuflecting towards an evolution without really having to capitulate towards it. So that might be another way of thinking about it. But, you know, this is a nomination. We'll wait and see how it goes. All we know is I think that Jeffrey Sachs is more than a little pissed.
But I think Jeffrey Sachs brought this about in some fashion. He offered himself as a sort of sacrificial candidate, but he got somebody who wants to put human welfare ahead of bean counting. And that feels to me like progress.
Yeah, but if you remember the bank's official slogan is, you know, or something, it's something along the lines of our vision is a world without poverty. Or as a friend of mine once put it, our poverty is a world bereft of vision. But, you know, the bank has been pushing in interesting ways. So this isn't really a complete surprise. I'll tell you what would have been a complete surprise. If they'd taken John Cochran from the University of Chicago or someone very, very orthodox in the old school sense and dumped them down, that actually would have been a surprise. This is less a surprise given everything that's happened over the past decade or so.
And what if President Obama had picked Larry Summers? This has also been a kind of low dumping ground for the likes of Paul Wolfowitz, for example, not to mention Robert McNamara and others. I mean, what about Larry Summers?
I think Larry has higher regard both for himself and for others than to take that job. I mean, and if it's seen as a dumping ground, why would he take it? He doesn't have to take it.
Beneath his dignity, so to speak.
I wouldn't say it's beneath his dignity. It's more than a decent job. It's a very important job, let's be frank. But, you know, his work hasn't really been in development. He has been on the inside track on the financial crisis, both in causing it and resolving it. And, you know, maybe it's just something he doesn't want to do at this point in time. I mean, you could offer me a job as your personal chef, and while I like cooking, that could be fun for a while, but I don't think it's right for me at this moment.
Mark Blyth, we met you around this word austerity. You were against it. The world seems reluctantly have backed into it or been backed into it. Why do I have a feeling that when this election year is over, we're going to be looking at new kinds of austerity here in the United States? Could be Social Security benefits. It could be transit service. It could be all kinds of different public spending. But why do we feel in our bones that we haven't seen the worst of it here?
Well, it depends on who wins the election, first of all. But let's assume there's a continuity in government, because there's nothing to explain if the Republicans win. Of course the Republicans will cut, and they will use the so-called crisis over debt to get whatever objectives they've long wanted to do. So that's not surprising. So the question is, if Obama wins re-election, will he actually become more austere? Well, why would he? first of all, he's not going to get elected again. So why would you want to preside over a period where you make things worse? Secondly, the economy, the American economy in comparison to the European economies, where they really are doing austerity, looks really good in comparison at the moment. Now, things are still awful in large parts of the country, and I'm not saying that that's not the case, but the trajectory is certainly upwards in terms of employment, growth figures, etc., etc. In Europe, it's all heading south. So you have a natural experiment in the world. You have that big thing called the EU that's doing the stuff that's meant to bring growth, and it's not bringing growth. It's actually increasing debt. On the other hand, you've got a country that if it grows very fast, which the United States is capable of, it can pay back more debt by growing than it ever could by cutting things. So the onus would have to be on some kind of evidence that we don't have so far that really this is going to work. Now, this isn't going to work for reasons that we've spoken about before. You can't all cut at once and expect the economy to grow. While it makes sense for any one state to do this, it relies on everybody else spending while you're saving in order for it to work and all that sort of good stuff. But there's actually something structural that's come to my attention recently as being much more important than I thought. So I'll just lay this out for a minute if you give me a minute to do so. So I've always wondered why Germans don't understand fallacies of composition. What do I mean by that? So this whole thing that, you know, you can spend and I can spend, but if we get into debt, then what we need to do is one of us needs to cut back. But if we both cut back at the same time, right, there's a problem. So what becomes individually rational becomes collectively disastrous. That's a fallacy of composition. Now, of course, Germans understand this, but all of the public rhetoric, making the whole crisis about Greece, making the whole crisis about profligate states, they have to know that that's not true. The evidence simply isn't there. So why have these guys been banging on about it? And why are they determined that not just Greece, everybody in Europe ends up with a smaller amount of debt on its balance sheet? Why is this so important? Well, think about this. So if you take the top five American banks, and this is a 2010 figure, it only comes to about 56% of GDP. If you take all the American banks, all the credit unions, the piggy bank under your bed, the whole lot and add it together, it's still just under 100% of GDP. So it's about $14 trillion on a $15 trillion economy. European bank assets, aka all the crap that they've got stuffed in the bank that's meant to be an asset that's actually a liability, $45 trillion on a $14 trillion economy. They're too big to bail. Now here's your problem. It's called the euro. This is why this gets interesting. Everybody has the same currency. So suddenly what that means is every little last bank in Europe, whether you're in Spain or Germany or whatever that uses the euro, you can buy assets all over the country now, all over the European area. So what was once an international transaction is now a national transaction. Only it's not. Because although your liabilities are denominated in the same currency, right? I'm a German bank, I buy an asset, a hotel in Spain. I own it, it's valued in euros. In a sense, it's just like I own it in Germany. Actually, it's not, particularly if it's your bank subsidiary in Spain that's been doing the loaning. Now, what that means is your bank then falls under what are two different resolution regimes. Is it the Spanish guys who take care of it if the bank fails? Is it the German guys who take care of it if the bank fails? So you've got these huge, highly levered banks, right? Way more levered than Lehman Brothers actually ever was at the height of the crash.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Much bigger bank footprints. These guys have never had Glass-Steagall. They've been universal banks from the beginning. It's not unusual for big French banks to run 50 times leverage. So that means a 2% turn against your assets, and you're done. So you've got all these banks. Since the introduction of the euro, they've been buying lots of periphery debt. That's now choking up their balance sheets. They have been cut out of US wholesale funding markets, where they used to borrow their money from, in order to like keep the machine going. So the European Central Bank's turned on the taps with this thing called the LTROs, the long-term refinancing options. And basically they've chucked €1 trillion in liquidity at them for 3 years at 1%. Basically just keep the whole thing going. It's kicking the can down the road, massive style, right? So here's your problem. At the end of the day, if you've got cross-national liabilities, but you've got national responsibilities for the banks, and if any one of these banks goes, it might take down the whole system. That means every single government has to be able to take one of its major banks on its balance sheet. If you're America and you've run in 40-50% debt to GDP and your big banks fail, you can do that. You'll end up with 75% net debt. That's where we are. If you're already Italy, if you've got 100% or 120% of GDP on debt, and one of your big banks fail, how on earth are you going to save it? So this whole thing is about clearing enough space on the balance sheet of the governments at a national level to to act as shock absorbers, to act as insurance policies, to make sure that if any one of those banks goes, you can take it on the balance sheet of the state and it doesn't blow up, causing a contagion across the whole Eurozone that will take the whole thing down. This whole austerity thing in Europe is an unintended consequence of the euro. That's what it's really all about. And it took me ages to figure that out.
Explain just what that means. I've been 3 weeks in Italy since I've seen you. And we kept moving around this beautiful, elegant, interesting country, wonderful public services, all the wonderful stuff that tourists go there for. And I kept thinking, how long would it take to figure out that this place is in a financial crisis? What in the world is the connection between the so-called crisis of Italy and the day-to-day life of millions and millions of happy Italians?
Well, the global version of it you might call trickle-down class warfare. I mean, essentially, the banks blew up, and in order to save them in the US case, because they were too big to fail, we bailed them. And when you bail them, all that debt goes from the private sector to the public sector, and the public sector debt means debt that we have to pay off. That's the simple mechanism. What you've got in the European case is that on steroids. They're too big to bail. Plus, they were also borrowing short-term in the US and lending long-term in Europe. And then you've got all these cross-border liabilities in the Eurozone itself with these massively levered banks that are bigger than American banks in many cases. You've got a big, big problem. So everything looks like it's great because the European Central Bank under Monti has actually done half a Bernanke. So what do I mean by half a Bernanke? Bernanke gets a lot of crap for turning the Fed into a bad bank. That is, taking the really bad, troublesome mortgage assets from the banks and giving them cash. And the critique of this, what's called quantitative easing, this asset swap, where they give us crap assets and we give them money, is that it doesn't do any good, or it leads to commodity inflation, or the banks are sitting on the money. Now, they can't all simultaneously be true, right? It can't be going out of the country to cause inflation in commodities, which comes back home, if the bank's sitting on it, not doing anything with it. So we kind of need to make up our mind about what story's true. But let's just say the banks usually are just sitting on it. They're not investing because they're in a recession, and it's kind of stupid to invest large amounts of cash in the middle of a recession. Perfectly reasonable. Just as they're not lending, people aren't borrowing. So you got all this quantitative easing out there. Now imagine the economy comes back. A lot of those really toxic assets sitting in the Fed that were brought onto the Fed's balance sheet will regain value. In fact, some guys on Wall Street are already trying to get their hands on them, repackage them, and sell them on. So, in a sense, what that QE is an investment in toxic assets at a really low price that if they come back, the Fed makes a profit from. Now, the ECB is constitutionally limited from not doing that. It can accept certain forms of debt, AAA rated, AA rated, etc. So you forget Greek bonds, so they can't do this, right? But they're only able to do a certain amount of this stuff. But what they can do, once you get the Germans off the board, which is what's happened in the past couple of months, is you can turn on the taps. So beginning in December, half a trillion euros went out in these LTRO, long-term refinancing obligations, and another half a trillion just went out in March, a 1%. So inflation in the Eurozone is 2%, basically. I'm giving you a huge amount of money at 1%. What are you going to do with it? Well, if you've got any sense, you'll buy some of my government debt. Because I'm guaranteeing you that loan for 3 years. So if you buy my short-term paper, which is sitting around at 5%, and I gave you the money to do it at 1%, I'm handing you 4% yield. Now, here's the interesting thing. Some of the banks are doing that. Most of them aren't. They took three-quarters of that money and put it right back at the ECB on deposit for 0.25. Well, why would you do that? Basically, you're borrowing at 1%, and then I'm giving it you back, and you're then giving me a quarter of a percent. This makes no sense. It's like I'm paying you money for holding the free money you just gave me. Yeah, but think about it this way. Imagine the banks know what I know and what you know, that the whole thing's very, very fragile and could go up at any minute. Would you like to be holding a bunch of government debt that you might make money on 3 years from now? Or would you rather have half a trillion dollars sitting there as an insurance fund for which you're paying 25? No question what they're going to do. So basically, the banks are sitting on the money, just as they are in the United States, rather than lending it. And the problem for the ECB is they can't even invest in the crappy assets, get it off the banks' books, help the banks clear their balance sheets. If you can't do any of that, you're stuck. The only thing you can do is austerity.
Come back to this country, Mark Blythe. Last fall, you were one of those people who felt that the Occupy movement had really hit a nerve, even in your own experience as an immigrant to this country, of the polarization of incomes, the decline of public services, student debt, this kind of thing. And then suddenly the cold came, the police came, and Occupy for the moment was over. People talk now about a recovery, but I'm wondering, when will we see it again? And what will it sound like? Or will it effectively be suspended in terms of gripping the people's attention until the election is over?
Well, actually, I don't know. I really don't know about this. I was going to say the election is going to be a distraction, but why should it be? It might be the case that things are warming up again. You get the same kind of demonstration effect. Let's say the people in Oakland decide to go back because that was one of the most violent clear-outs for the movement. They make a stand there. Zuccotti comes back. Suddenly you start to get a global movement again. I mean, it could happen. It might not. It might happen. I mean, there's no way of knowing, right? But let's say that what made that possible were a series of structural preconditions. In other words, when the credit bubble burst, facts were revealed about the world that people didn't like and they got really pissed. And that's why they were there, particularly young people who are the most badly affected by this. Youth unemployment is practically at a post-war high right across all the developed countries. That hasn't changed. It still costs an arm and a leg to go to college at a time when people have no access to credit or less access to credit. And even if you get the credit, given the state of the economy, you're not sure it's worth the investment. Healthcare is being debated in the Supreme Court as we speak, because some people apparently have a problem with the notion that people might actually be covered from the point of view of it being a public good. So all of these things which were hugely problematic to begin with, the way that the Fed dealt with the banks and so on and so forth, lots of different streams of discontent fed into that movement. You had everything from Tea Partiers to Trotskyites. It was all over the place. Remember, people kept saying, so what do these guys want? You know, what are their demands? And it's like, well, who the hell are they? They haven't even figured that out yet. So I think all of that's still in the mix. So we're going to see something come back, whether it's Occupy in the same form, we don't know. But even if there's a recovery, I think that the estimate I saw in the press the other day was that if we keep growing at this rate, it's going to take something absurd like 13 consecutive quarters of growth to get back to reasonable levels of unemployment. And that's on the measure that gives us a better reading to start with in terms of making it look good. U3 is the measure from the BLS, rather than U6, which is much broader. That one's still sitting at around 14%. So when you have youth unemployment of around 20%, then you've got a problem.
Occupy produced some populist speeches on the part of President Obama. It implanted the 1% line, which I think is interesting, and nobody denies it. People feel it. It's become sort of part of the guilty conscience of the country, that we're not the robust middle-class society that we thought we were or pretend we are. But then what? Where do policymakers, where do writers and thinkers like you go with that kind of tentative start?
Well, a lot of this is a kind of intergenerational problem. There's a friend of mine called Sven Steinmo. He's a very, very good political economist. He's an American guy of Norwegian descent who teaches the EUI in Florence in Italy. And he's writing a book, and the book starts off like this. Why is it whenever my son or daughter say to me, what do I want for my birthday, what do I want for my Christmas? And I say, oh, nothing. And the reason is because I have everything. My generation has absolutely everything. So he came of age when it was perfectly possible in the 1960s to go to Berkeley for $400, and he did. And then he could go to grad school, and then he got picked up in a higher education system that was expanding. And he lived through the 1980s and the 1990s when investments were booming. And now he's the guy who's coming up for a pension, and he's got two properties, and he lives in Italy, and so on and so forth. And all the people down below him, including his kids, between them can't afford a mortgage. So there's an intergenerational problem here in that the people who vote and the people that politicians tend to pander to in the United States tend to be old. They tend to be gray. They have the money. They have the pensions. They have it all, and they're not giving it up for anyone. So you have an intergenerational conflict that really hasn't yet spoken its name. Maybe that's the new way that Occupy comes out. But you see little bits of this. You see the public, or some Republicans coming out and saying, well, if college is too expensive, maybe college isn't for everyone. Well, you know, if that's your public policy solution for a 21st century economy, really, you're done. Go back to sharecropping. Go back to exporting tar and molasses, because that's what your skill level is going to be. Now, we were making mistakes for many years because we were putting, in 2006 figures, 31% of MIT grads into finance rather than into engineering our way out of global warming. Enormous destruction of talent for no apparent gain. Engineering zero-sum derivatives rather than positive-sum products, but there you go. There's some signs that that's changing, in part because the financial sector's shrinking. But if at the same time the response to what we do next is, well, let's hollow out all the state education systems. Let's make it impossible for the middle class to sustain themselves. Let's really polarize and impoverish the country. We're done. It's over. The Chinese will have our lunch. The Germans will have our lunch. Let me give you a good example of the Germans on this. Nobody noticed this. 2 years ago, they decided they were phasing out nuclear power completely. Nuclear power is around 20% of their electricity generating capacity. If you spend any time in Germany in the winter, you will know one thing. It faces Russia and it's cold. This is not something you screw around with. So what are these guys going to do? Well, when you think about Germany, you think about, apart from austerity and madness in the Eurozone, really good engineers, right? You think about people that still have serious apprenticeships, serious skills. And an entire engineering culture based on what's called the Mittelstand, the small, medium-sized, world-class, very, very highly high-quality engineering firms that they have.
You're talking to a German microphone, I'm sure.
Exactly, I'm sure I'm talking to a German microphone. That means it won't break. Anyway, the point is, what they've basically decided to do is to go all in on alternative energy. They're going to put about 300 billion euros into it just to get started over the next 10 years. They're bringing together all their top guys, all their firms, collaborative research between them. They're not competing. They're trying to develop the best technologies, wind, solar, everything. Why? Because they know something we're in denial about. The oil's running out. That's a fact. The planet's warming up. That's a fact. You can call it climate change chicanery if you want, but basically your head's up your ass and you're not paying attention. The Germans don't believe any of that stuff. And they know we've got one shot and one shot only. Whoever figures out how to make sustainable green tech in the next 30 years gets to sell it to everybody else for the next 1,000. That's what they've figured out. What are we doing? We're shutting down our engineering. We're hollowing out our skills. We're closing down our options. The Germans are going to have our lunch.
After the Chinese, you mean?
Well, I'd say the Chinese will definitely be in for the appetizers, but the Germans are going to take the main.
Mark, we've got new leaders, wannabe leaders, shifts in global leadership in England, in China, in Latin America. What difference is that going to make? And what's the trend coming out of the world politics of this economic crisis?
Well, as you know, as somebody who thinks that prediction's a fool's game, you keep asking me to predict things.
And you keep answering.
And I keep getting them right sometimes.
And your scorecard's that bad.
No, I have to say, it's kind of weird. Spend all that time saying you can't predict, and then it turns out you're actually not bad at it. Let me put it this way. I think that a lot of the stuff that's talked about, the decline of the US and a lack of American leadership capacity and the decline of the EU and all that sort of stuff, is complete hogwash. For one very simple reason. If you spend any time in Shanghai, you will notice that Shanghai is a tremendously modern city that has an internal sort of Gini coefficient or degree of inequality that's somewhere between the United States and Belgium. Internally in the city itself, right? You know, they've got a lot of some very, very rich people. They've got, you know, reasonable amount of middle class people and a reasonable amount of what we call working class people. If you go 50 miles outside of Shanghai, the Gini coefficient looks like Zimbabwe, as does much of the country. Its per capita GDP is still low. Oh, but there's lots of them. Yes, that's true. And they're still one of the highest saving countries in the world. 38% of income gets saved. You're saving that much, that tells me something about your country. You're not very confident about the future, are you? Because if you were, you'd be investing a lot more. Now, they do invest, but what do they consume? Very little in comparison. So you take Chinese consumption and track it up against EU consumption and US consumption, and you've got $20 trillion in the EU and the US combined, and you've got 1.9 in China. How on earth does one-tenth take leadership over that? Particularly when China itself has been notoriously, let's say, opaque in its desires for assuming any such leadership mantle in the first place. What exactly is the Beijing model? We know what the Washington consensus was. We know that the Americans broadly like certain things. What exactly do the Chinese want? Why are they in Africa? What do they do with these bilateral deals? What's the long-term plan? Do they even know? Because if they don't know, how do they lead anybody else? So let's move to the BRICS, the rest of them. Russia? Really? Come on, male life expectancy in Russia is worse than Dundee, where I grew up. That has one of the highest rates of lung cancer, bowel cancer, heart attacks, strokes, and everything else in the Western world. They're running out of oil. That's their trick. Brazil is a commodity exporter. If the commodities markets go down, Brazil goes down. As does Australia, by the way, and they're already getting whacked. Chinese growth just fell from 10% a year to 7.5%. So what's this whole thing about the US is in terminal decline? I remember hearing that first in the 70s. Remember that? We were going down the tubes in the 70s?
With Japan then, right?
Japan. And then Japan blew up. And then it was the unipolar moment, and we were going to run everything. It turned out you couldn't do that. And now it's China that's come along, and China's the one that's going to come along and take our lunch. Now, that may contradict what I said earlier, because you're like, but hang on, Mark. Didn't you just say the Chinese are going to have our lunch? It's always possible to lose what you've got through acts of your own stupidity. And we are well equipped for being the most stupid nation in the world when it comes to irrational public policy choices. But we would have to shoot ourselves first before anything would happen that would seriously change an American-dominated global order. One final thing to think about. What's the alternative to holding dollars? Gold? You still have to turn your gold into money. What exactly are China's assets? $3.4 trillion in US cash and treasuries. So clearly their assets are only as good as our paper, because their assets are our paper. Funny how people forget to mention that.
I keep wondering why we don't talk in this country more about alternatives to unregulated capitalism. I mean, it's been an outside the Republican presidential primary, our system is recognizable as a sort of embarrassment. And people like your friends, Martin Wolf and others at the Financial Times, a lot of serious people, Judge Posner in Chicago, worry about capitalism. Like, let's, you know, pick up the clue phone, everybody. But where are we?
Oh, I think we have to make some not too subtle differences in this, right? When we're worrying about capitalism, what do we really mean by that? Well, I think what we really mean by that, and I could be wrong, is we're worried about people who have been taking home unbelievable amounts of compensation for the past 20 years in the financial sector for essentially having public insurance, which has blown up and they've now claimed, and doing things of very little social value. And they're very politically connected and very politically powerful, and many of them have been members of the government. And it turns out that some of them are even crooks. So we're very freaked out about that. And that's what we mean by, oh, capital has gone bad. Do we really mean that sort of, you know, American small businesses need to be rethought? I mean, is that what we're saying? Are we really saying that, you know, manufacturing in America needs to be rethought?
Which manufacturing in America?
Well, any manufacturing. I don't know. Basically, let's say, for example, good point. We don't make anything. No, that's not true. Well, let's say aircraft manufacturing. We're still the world's largest aircraft manufacturers. So we need to basically do what? Turn Boeing into a series of socialist co-ops. Maybe that might work. I'm not sure of the productivity advantages you get from that. So, yes, there's lots of things that are wrong with capitalism, but most of it was kind of ground zero for the financial sector. Now, you can also look at CEO pay. Really interesting work by a guy called Robert Boyer in Paris, who looks at what he calls the CEO-CFO nexus. And essentially what he tracks over time is how pay in the manufacturing sector for top executives tracked that in the financial sector. Why? Well, basically, they were looking at how much those guys were getting paid, and they were turning around to their boards and saying, oh, come on. So this is why it goes from multiples of like 20 to 1, 30 to 1, to 100 to 1, to 200 to 1, because it's all tracking what's going on in the financial sector. Now, why do you get such outside pay in the financial sector? Because their compensation packages are completely different. It's based upon bonuses and stock options and other such things. They have nothing to do with income in the sense that 99% of Americans know. So you end up with this really weird system that's generating both super profits and super income for a very, very small part of the economy, in a sense directing what's going on in other parts of the economy, mainly for ill. That's what needs to be regulated. In terms of that, it's not just a regulatory solution. I actually think that we're halfway there already and people don't realize this.
Explain.
Well, I think we've talked about this before. I mean, I think the basic business model of investment banking's bust. I mean, I see this at Brown, right? Students not only don't want to go into it because the sector's been tainted, those firms just aren't recruiting the way that they used to. And the way they're not, the reason they're not recruiting is because their fixed costs are going up. Why? Because it's harder to give bonuses. You might have to put it in an escrow. You might have to pay taxes on it. You might have to hold it for 3 years. Okay, well, what else? Well, basically, apart from the stock market going up because it's the only place to put your money, what are you going to do? Buy European bank debt. Good luck with that. So apart from that going up, what exactly are there to invest in? Are there hundreds of IPOs like there was in the 1990s? Are there thousands of mergers and acquisitions deals going on? No, it's all flat. So if you've got really, really expensive people, high fixed costs, and your revenues are going down, the only thing you can do is shrink your balance sheet. So these banks are getting smaller, not bigger. And the ones that aren't getting smaller, the ones who are thinking out of the box on this, JP Morgan's a good example, are really thinking about turning themselves into the equivalent of Best Buy for banking. So you do big box retail. And the way that Jamie Dimon looks at it, he says, if the world economy continues on the way it is, big caveat emptor on that one, right? But, you know, if it does, then there's going to be a lot of multinationals in the world that are not American. It's going to be Brazilian multinationals, Chinese multinationals. They're going to be opening up factories all over the place. They're going to be hiring workers. They're going to want to do deals with suppliers. They're going to do all the normal stuff that commercial banks do. We should be prepared to do that work. So the ones that are agile and nimble and looking ahead are already looking past the investment banking model. So imagine a situation where you go through all the trouble of doing Dodd-Frank, as I like to call it, too big to read. And the very thing that is meant to regulate it is basically pushed out of half out of existence by the very market forces that these guys love so much. That would be a delicious irony.
You introduced us to the idea of kicking the can down the road. It turns out to be a very long road, Mark.
Oh, it is. They just gave it the biggest hoof you can imagine with these LTROs. And the deal is, you give me a few assets and I'll give you as much money as you can spell. This is the deal between the ECB and the European banks. And as I said, I'll give you it for 1%. So imagine a 1% loan. Imagine just the two of us, right? I said to you, Chris, you're a very, very well-off man. I need to buy a house in Boston and I can't get a loan. So can you give me a loan? And you say, sure, I've got lots of extra cash. And I say, give it to me for 1%. Now, if we were not friends, you would be like, but then I'm losing money. Because, I mean, in any environment, in any positive inflation environment, if you're paying me back 1% after 3 years, I've lost money on that. That's insane. That's exactly what they're doing. They're so keen for these banks to take these loans, they're willing to lose money on it right out the door.
Mark, you are my friend, but I wouldn't give you money at 1%. Yet.
I think that's perfectly reasonable, particularly because I'm Scottish. I would expect anyone who lent me money at 1% to be feeble of mind.
Stop into the pub anytime, Mark. You've explained a lot, as you always do. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Let's hope that we can do this in better circumstances one day, rather than talking about how much it sucks.
Thank you.